The Woman's Choice Eastside Woman's Clinic versus Newman.
May it please the Court. In adopting Public Law 187 and its in the presence requirement, the Indiana General Assembly was merely following the lead of Pennsylvania and the Supreme Court's Casey decision.
If you you and the district court keep referring to this as the in the presence requirement, but does this case have anything to do with whether the advice is given in the presence of the physician?
Well, the statute requires that the mandated information.
The only question on the table is the time, is it not?
I think it's actually whether the information is given in the presence of the woman. It has to be given 18 hours before, and indeed the district court upheld the time period, but just said that enjoined the in the presence
right.
part.
Basically that the advice has to be live rather than over the phone or over the internet or something like that.
Face-to-face, in person, in the presence is the way the statute reads. And that's a requirement that Casey understood to be in part of the Pennsylvania statute and upheld the Pennsylvania statute in that part, and indeed.
But isn't it fair to say, Mr. Fisher, that in a sense this is a case of first impression in the sense that neither Casey nor Carlin nor the other cases have really zeroed in the way your briefing has and the briefing on the other side in the particular aspect of the in-person or in-the-presence requirement. There have been cases that have looked at advance notice provisions. Most of them have actually been 24 hours, not 18, but I frankly can't see any practical difference between the two. But cases have focused on that and cases have focused on other things. But no one has dissected out, if you will, the in the presence plus 24 hours for extended consideration and discussion. It's just been part of a bigger picture.
Well, I'm not sure that I agree with that, particularly, well, with respect to both Casey and Carlin. They both understood that those laws included
well, the they understand it, but I reread Carlin very carefully before this argument. I don't see the kind of focus on that requirement that these briefs have given us. And to that extent, it seems to me, when the district court has made a finding that on these particular facts, this combination of things in the circumstances of Indiana will be an undue burden, this case is new. Nobody was looking at that combination of things in quite the same way you have.
I must respectfully disagree that I think in Carlin the court was. Simply part of what was going on in Carlin were many other things. And so
they never talked about in the present.
Well, they
talk about the advance notice requirement. Nobody's focusing on how it happened.
Well, they're looking at the same data, for sure, about what happened in
data, yes, but I'm trying to get you to agree to one little tiny thing. You know, we can talk about the data, but I didn't see a focus in Carlin or Casey on the interaction of these things, and so it strikes me to that extent. Your case is, there's nothing wrong with being a first case, but it seems to me it's the first one that really requires the court to focus on that interaction.
I have to respectfully disagree. I think Carlin and Casey both understood and addressed the same kind of requirement that's at issue here. And the district court then went the other direction from Carlin and Casey on this issue and was wrong to do so for four independent reasons. It shifted the burden from the plaintiff to the defendant to prove the lack of
that's what surprised me right there.
And the district court, in fact, talked about how powerful it was that the state had not come forward with proof.
But
on
that's
this
the word the district court used. It was come forward. I read the court's opinion to say that there was a lot of evidence from the plaintiff showing the undue burden, and that in terms of producing anything, coming forward with is the usual phrase we use in terms of producing. The state hadn't suggested anything, so there he was with a lot on one side and nothing on the other side. Had the state come forward with anything, it would have been a different kind of case at a minimum. I'm not sure I saw, and indeed he has the sentence, which I guess you're asking us to disregard utterly, that he understands where the burden of proof lies. It's on the plaintiff.
before.
Well, that's right, but we also have to look at what the district court purported to rely on, which were studies, anecdotal evidence, and some statistical studies from Indiana and North Dakota where there was no in-person requirement in the place at any point, and also the statistics on interstate travel, which don't tell us anything about whether an in-person requirement can have a persuasive impact. It merely suggests that some women would prefer to avoid having to go through the in-person requirement. So there's nothing even on that side of the ledger that can justify a finding on persuasiveness other than the shifting of the burden to the defendant.
Well,
all right, counsel, why don't you continue with your argument, then we can hear.
The other large error that we point to from the district court is that it required no proof of how the in-the-presence requirement is an actual substantial obstacle. The district court said that the plaintiffs were not required to prove the precise mechanism by which an in-the-presence requirement can lead to the perceived declines in abortion rates in Mississippi.
Can I ask you if you think it's a matter of law after Casey and Carlin? I think I know what your answer is going to be, but I just want to confirm that it is impossible anywhere in the United States for any court on any factual record to find that a 24-hour period is an undue burden.
Should I take the 24-hour period to mean the in-the-presence?
Any 24-hour period, since you seem to think they all are the same. So I just want to know whether you think that Casey and Carlin, as a matter of law, mean that there is no longer any fact-finding to be made.
Well, I think that, fairly right, Casey and Carlin do purport to leave the door open on this issue, so I don't want to suggest that okay. They conclusively close it. But I think what has to be part of the proof that wasn't present here is some explanation, some qualitative explanation, and proof of how it works. Similar to in Casey, for example, where the court struck down spousal notification because it could describe in a qualitative manner and find proof of how requiring a woman who wants an abortion to notify a spouse would put the spouse in between the woman and the abortion. And there's no suggestion of that. In fact, Casey looked at lots of statistics about how some abusive spouses subject their wives to abuse, and despite that record and despite acknowledging that it could be troubling that the waiting period and in-person requirements could lead to a better chance that a disapproving spouse might learn of this, it upheld it anyway. That's exactly the kind of burden that Casey upheld. And here the district court looked at, in a footnote, mentioned a psychologist affidavit that even the district court acknowledged didn't show undue burden on its own. That again goes beyond nothing more than what Casey already had before in any event. So there's been no showing here of the mechanics by which this could work. And that's a big part of the shortcomings in the Mississippi study, in the sense of not providing any causation, any taking control of all the possible confounding variables that may come into it.
What about the JAMA article, which does look at the other two similar states, which seems to me the authors were saying would in fact account for the other confounding variables? You've controlled for everything except the one element, and now you see how it works out.
Well, I think that there's a problem there, that even Dr. Henshaw testified that you always have problems when you look at other states. They don't necessarily control for everything. Indeed, he testified that even an observational study in and of itself could have enough problems, or generally you can't account for all the confounding variables, and Dr. Way identified many of those. The point about the confounding variables, again, this is where persuasiveness comes into it as well. There's no way to account for the persuasive effect just by comparing to the other two states.
Didn't the woman from Utah who runs the clinics, or North Dakota, the one who said that when you get to the part of the persuasion saying that the putative father would have to support the children, that half the people who heard that advice laughed?
Well, that may be, but it doesn't tell us what would happen if the woman had to come in the presence, and apart from that particular information, what the woman might learn or come away with by a personal interaction on the other information. So again, that doesn't tell us anything about the persuasive effect of the in-person requirement.
Counsel, why don't you continue with your own argument?
But I do appreciate your answering my question. It's very courteous.
I shouldn't, but he wants to get his argument.
Well, and I'm interested in my questions being answered. Thank you.
Another part of this is that Henshaw's post-trial fixes here to the problems with the Mississippi study that Carlin identified are not sufficient to fill the holes that Carlin identified, in particular the failure to account for the number of women going from Mississippi to Louisiana. There in the end, what we had was an attempt to just look at the middle third, roughly, of Mississippi to figure out what was going on there, an effort that doesn't take into account the transients or women who might have gone from the middle of Mississippi out of state, and certainly doesn't have any assurance of representativeness of what was going on in the rest of
Mississippi. I don't see, counsel, how you're going to get anywhere on this line of argument. This is the very kind of thing that a district judge has to decide after a trial. And if all you're doing, or if the principal thing you think you're doing, is asking us to disagree with the district judge's inferences based on the factual record, I don't see where you'd go anywhere. I had thought your better point is that what burden is undue is not what burden is undue in the eyes of district judges, but what burden is undue in the eyes of justices of the Supreme Court. And if you were to just take the district court's factual findings as given, you still have any argument left?
Yes, we go back again to the
point. You might want to make it then.
We go back to the point where there's been no showing of how, in fact, the in-the-presence requirement could impose, in a mechanical sense, the undue burden. How that is undue as opposed to just imposing the collateral kinds of consequences that Casey deemed to be perhaps troubling. But
well, the record shows, or at least the district court found, the record shows that this requirement, which I don't want to refer to as the in-the-presence requirement, it's a requirement of making two visits to the clinic. At the first one, you get advice, and then the second one, you can have the abortion if you want. Whether the requirement of two visits to the clinic is an undue burden. Now, what is it that defines what's undue? Let's just take it as given that that decreases the demand for abortions by 10%. How do we know whether that's undue or not?
Well, I think we look at Casey and we look at spousal notification, which is the classic example there. How the spouse, putting the spouse between the woman and the abortion has nothing to do with the proper goals of a legislature in trying to persuade women not to have abortions or in protecting maternal health. Whereas here, this has a legitimate goal of protecting maternal health and of persuading women not to have abortions, and it doesn't put in as a direct obstacle.
You're not getting to my question, though. I'm assuming that there are valid state goals here. That's a holding of Casey. I'm also assuming that the valid state goals can't be achieved by placing an undue burden on women. And my assumption is that what is undue is in the eyes of the justices rather than the eyes of particular district judges. And that leads to the question whether a 10% decrease in the abortion rate shows that the burden is undue. How do we know the answer to that question?
I think we know the answer in part because the statistic itself is not enough. There has to be something qualitative, like spousal notification. That, in any event, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right, counsel.
May it please the court. The state's appeal in this case is largely an effort to replace the findings of the district court with different proposed findings that the state prefers. We believe the district court's judgment should be affirmed on two grounds.
Well, they're not making any headway, with me at least, on that. But I have for you the same question that I had for your adversary, which is, how does one know whether, assuming it's true, that this law reduces the demand for abortions by 10%, how do we know whether that's undue or not?
If I may rephrase the court's question a little bit.
No, I'd really like you to answer the question that I've asked, because that would be most useful to me in making my decision.
I understand, Your Honor. If the statute simply reduces the demand for abortion, if I understand that to mean prevents 10% of women from obtaining abortion, I think that clearly constitutes a large fraction of women seeking abortion within the meaning of Casey. And I say that for two reasons.
Suppose the data were to show that a state requirement, or it's actually something imposed by the market, that in order to get eyeglasses, you have to go to the ophthalmologist twice. You go once and you have your prescription read and a glaucoma test will be done. You come back the second time and they actually have your eyeglasses ready. You have to go twice. Now, let us suppose that that reduces the number of pairs of eyeglasses that are bought. I will bet anything that it's true. How would we know whether having to go twice is an undue burden on eyeglasses?
Well, I think there are two issues one would look at. First, were those who no longer obtained eyeglasses doing so because they freely chose not to?
They freely chose what?
They freely chose not to get eyeglasses.
There will be some percentage of the population for which one visit is tolerable and two are not. Just as there's some percentage of the population for which if you just increase the price of something, the demand will go down. That was the premise, you'll recall, of the Ninth Circuit's holding in Masaryk against Armstrong, that having abortions performed by a physician was an undue burden, because physicians are more expensive than nurses, and therefore the demand, the number of abortions performed, necessarily goes down. The Supreme Court reversed that 9-0.
Well, my recollection, of the Ninth Circuit's opinion in Masaryk was that it suggested that there was an impermissible purpose for Montana statute, and the Supreme Court reversed on that basis because there was no
term. The legislature wanted that effect to happen, and that's often the case for these medical warning things, giving people warnings about what's going to happen to them, whether it's for abortion or for other medical procedures. The state may want that to happen. But we've got this test which speaks in terms of undue burden, and I'm just asking whether you have some way that will help us to match the quantitative effect which we can observe in this record with the definition of what is undue.
Well, may I suggest an alternative or second way of looking at this issue, which is...
Before you do that, though, let me explore this a little further, because there's the quantitative effect. Let's take the spousal notification in Casey. There was also a quantitative effect of reduction in abortion demand because of spousal notification. And there the court linked up that quantitative effect with the issues about spousal notification and said, in fact, the reason that we're observing this for a significant number of people, for the people in abusive relationships for whom it counts, is because this particular requirement is a de facto prohibition on abortions for these people. It isn't just more expensive. It isn't just, you know, two trips or what have you. It isn't just going to get your spouse's consent. And I think the question in this record is, even if you accept the 10 to 13% reduction in demand, what is it to show that the two-visit requirement is the same kind of de facto prohibition in this deeper sense of the term, I mean, than just, oh, it's hard, so some people are going to give up, which is perhaps what the legislature wants.
Well, there's significant evidence in this record that this statute operates through coercive effects rather than through persuasion.
It operates what, please?
Through coercive effects on
how?
Women.
How?
Well, first of all, there's evidence in the record that when this information was provided to women in Indiana, it had no persuasive effect on women. The percentage of women keeping their appointments for abortions prior to the information being given was exactly the same, if not less, than when the information was provided to women.
But where's the coercive effect?
So the
law is passed in Illinois saying that these one-stop eyeglasses shops are all going to be closed because we in Illinois think they do shoddy work, and we're going to require the ophthalmologist model of at least two stops. Would you say that that had a coercive effect on people who wanted eyeglasses? Would raise the effective price of eyeglasses, surely. Where's the coercion?
Well, there's not necessarily coercion there, but that's a very different situation. That restriction operates on the number of providers, which is different than a restriction that operates on the customers of the service. If the customer were told, you must drive 200 miles around in circles before you can go to the eyeglass provider, that would be coercive, because it is not, primarily because it's not related to some a legitimate result that the state can seek to achieve. In this case, the Supreme Court has identified that one legitimate goal, or the legitimate goal of this type of statute, is to persuade women to carry a pregnancy to term. Here, so there's two pieces of evidence that one has to put together. And
have they ruled that that's wrong?
Oh, no. They've ruled that that's appropriate.
I didn't think so.
It's certainly appropriate for the state to make an effort to persuade women not to have abortion.
Right.
Absolutely. So here, in this record, the district court put together two pieces of evidence. first, the piece of evidence from Indiana, from North Dakota as well, that the information required here does not persuade women. And secondly, it looked at information from Utah.
Where are we going to go? There's a federal statute with respect to real estate disclosures, which says that before you can close on a piece of real estate, you have to give certain information a certain time in advance, and then you close on at a later date. And presumably the idea is to dissuade people from making rash decisions with respect to real estate, give them more time to shop, give them more time to compare against renting. Is it your view that if you did an empirical study and showed that the people who got that warning closed on their real estate at the same rate as people who didn't get that warning or advice or 24-hour period, that the statute would become unconstitutional?
Well, no. But that's because no constitutional right is involved.
Owning your own house is a pretty fundamental right in America.
Well, I'm not sure that that closing on a particular piece of property would count as a fundamental right or any constitutional right. Perhaps a property interest of some
sort. Judge Wood wants to ask.
I'm sorry.
Property interests are protected by the Constitution. You may not have noticed, but they are.
I meant the interest or the right to close on a particular piece of property in a private transaction.
All I was going to say is one of the problems that we all have, I think, here is that the test adopted by Casey, the undue burden test, I don't think we're confessing anything out of school, is a pretty fuzzy concept, and the Supreme Court has explained it in a couple of applications, you know, at least Casey itself, and to the extent you can get anything out of Stenberg, it's there. And we need to figure out what this means, consistent with the thing that you also recognize, that states are entitled to prefer childbirth to abortion. We know that. And so we have to figure out, I'm not aware of any undue burden test in the real estate disclosure or ophthalmology areas, but you never know. You know, one could come along tomorrow. But our problem is to figure out what does an undue burden mean. And another question I had for you is, against whom is it measured? Is it enough if it's an undue burden for a small subset of women that are identifiable by some objective criteria, or are we looking at more than half the women in Indiana, or what are we supposed to look for in your view?
Well, I think the first part of the question is what sort of guidance has the Supreme Court given? And I think first, when looking at how they dealt with the spousal notice requirement, there's not very much guidance there because though they say a large fraction of women face substantial obstacles, they don't quantify that. They do give a qualitative description of the types of coercive effects on women, physical or mental abuse, the deterrent effect that in their view sufficed to render it constitutionally problematic. Here we have, as I was about to say a moment ago, the combination of a lack of persuasive effect from the information with evidence from two states, Mississippi and Utah.
How do you compare Mississippi for this reason? Isn't that one of the poorest states in the Union?
I believe it is.
And secondly, isn't that mostly a rural area as compared to Indiana? Far more rural.
I'm not sure if that's in the record, and I don't honestly know if the percentage of people living in cities is higher or lower in Mississippi than in Indiana. But Utah,
if you could finish maybe for the third time the comparison that you were about to make.
In both Utah and Mississippi, where the information was given in person, there was a dramatic decline in the number of abortions, a dramatic increase in the number of women leaving the state to obtain abortion, a dramatic decrease in the percentage of women coming from other states to those states to obtain abortion, an increase in the number or the proportion of second trimester abortions. All of this led the district court to properly infer that the information was not causing these effects in Utah or Mississippi.
And what year was that test? That you're relying on, please.
Which test?
The Utah and the Mississippi test.
Well, the Mississippi study covered a period from roughly 1992, I believe, to 1994.
And when did this country become aware of the danger of HIV, and was that question taken, was that problem taken into consideration in the Mississippi test?
I don't know when the nation became aware of HIV, but it was not taken into account in any of these studies.
You think that that could have an implication too?
I don't think so, because what
the fear of
the tests, that the statistical tests that were done measured specific interventions at specific times coinciding with implementations of laws. The Utah examination occurred much later, I think,
right,
roughly 1997, well after the Mississippi one. Both showed this dramatic decline, and thus the district court concluded it's not due to persuasion, it's due to the deterrent burdens of the law that this decline takes place. And the mechanisms of that, which the state said are unclear, are actually quite clear. Increased cost, increased risk that the woman's confidentiality will be breached if she has to be absent from home or school or the workplace on a second occasion. So the mechanisms of how this would occur are quite clear. This leads to the second argument that we've made for affirmance of the district court, which is that the statute serves neither of the legitimate interests recognized by the Supreme Court.
Well, counsel, you said that because she would miss school twice or something like that.
Yeah. Well,
what if she were just receiving treatment for some OB/GYN problem and she had to come back? Would that infer that it was an abortion?
No, but each time a woman is absent from work, school, or the home, increases the risk of discovery of what she's actually doing, particularly for a teenager.
But two times, you say it.
But each time increases the risk.
I see.
So there are a lot of mechanisms by which this might occur.
The difficulty I have with this line of argument is that you're really, what you're saying now, at least this line, is incompatible with Casey itself being rightly decided. And we have to assume that the law at issue in Casey is a constitutional law.
Yes, Your Honor. On the other hand, even Justice Souter, in his in-chambers opinion in Casey in 1994, indicated that the litigants in Pennsylvania were free to challenge that law as applied, as it had been implemented. And if they could prove an undue burden even in Pennsylvania, they might succeed in striking that law down. In fact, the Pennsylvania law has been implemented without an implementation requirement.
But I assume that means showing an undue burden in some way other than just the requirement of going twice to the abortion provider, because it was clear that the justices thought about that in Casey.
They did think about it in Casey, but they also, all the opinions in Casey recognized that a different record might lead to a different result, and I think
But a different record in what respect? That's the where I came in, basically saying, how is it that we understand what undue burden means? How can we know whether 10% is an undue burden?
My time is
I guess we're still there.
Why don't you answer him, and then you take two more minutes so that you can make your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right?
I think that the Supreme Court made a reasonable assumption, a reasonable factual assumption, that the information required by the Pennsylvania statute would have a persuasive effect. The record here shows that at least the information required by the Indiana law with respect to women in Indiana has no persuasive effect. That is, it doesn't advance the state's interest in potential life. The only effect it has in terms of persuasion was conceded by the state in the trial court, seemed to be to maybe increase the number of abortions that occur.
Now why don't you give your own argument that it hasn't been covered?
Thank you.
Go ahead. 2 minutes.
Thank you. Given the statement that I just made about the lack of any advancement of the interest in potential life, it's clear from the record here that the statute also fails to advance the state's interest in maternal health. Its only effects on maternal health are to delay women to obtain later abortions, therefore riskier abortions, deter them from obtaining abortions within the state, requiring them to travel longer distances. And therefore, the statute serves neither of the legitimate interests recognized by the Supreme Court from Roe through Casey, and is invalid for that reason as well under cases like Hodgson versus Minnesota and Planned Parenthood versus Danforth, where the court also was examining statutes which advance neither of the legitimate interests. That's a second tier of the undue burden test. If there is no substantial obstacle imposed, nevertheless, the statute must advance one of these legitimate interests. Because it does, because it advances neither of those interests, it's invalid for that reason as well. We therefore ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I think picking up on that last point by my colleague there, the point about Casey, and I think even coming from Carlin, is that the state is not required to show any sort of material advancement the way one would, for example, in a commercial speech case. It's enough under Carlin specifically.
Can you talk louder, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's enough, for example, under Carlin for there to be essentially a rational basis. It has to be rationally related to a legitimate government interest, which there are two of those here. Both the interest in persuading women not to have abortions and the interest in sound medical practice. Going back to a question that Judge Wood had asked earlier about subsets and whether this could be advanced by looking at subsets, I think Casey looked directly at this issue and said that there could be subsets of women, especially poor women, who might be particularly affected by a waiting period in the presence requirement. But even though it might have an impact, and even though that may be troubling, that did not amount to an undue burden. And here, there's even less evidence in the record than there was in Casey on that, because there's been no correlation between economic status or distance from a provider with the decline that was observed in Mississippi. So there's even less of an explanation qualitatively as to what's going on than there was in Casey. And indeed, there was no evidence coming out of Mississippi in any event to correlate the decline there with any persuasiveness or lack of persuasiveness of the law. And one part of the JAMA study that also leaps off the page, and this goes back to Your Honor's question about AIDS in a loose sense, is that there was a suggestion in the JAMA article that increased contraception could have occurred, and that could have explained both the decrease in abortions and the failure to observe any increase in births. So that's something else that comes in to partly address that issue of confounding variables. And if there are no further questions, I think I'm finished. Thank you.
Do you want to ask anything? All right. Thank you, counsel. We will take the case under advisement.